The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Greetings, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. I'm Eric Peabody, your loyal host and narrator. And tonight's episode features a trio of stories, a triple-headed monster with the same writer as its body. No, friends, this isn't the authorial debut of King Ghidorah, but it is the return of Jesse Pullins to Horror Hill. With three tales to get through this evening, I'll just be giving a quick synopsis of each here. First, we have Watch for Deer, where an inexperienced driver heading home on a dark road has a rather bizarre cervid encounter. Then, we're busting out the white sport coats and neon synthwave for a trip back to the 80s in Neon Nightmare. But first, you might want to wipe some of that, powdered sugar off your upper lip. Finally, we join the young, the suave, the deceptive Father Kane in My Last House Blessing, showcasing a grinning charlatan that is unaware that he is about to perform his, well, his last house blessing. Three stories. How can we even begin to fit so much spookiness into one episode? Stay tuned to find out. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, to begin our Jesse Pullins extravaganza, I give you Watch for Deer. The roads are different at night. It's something my mom used to say all the time. She said it when I was a child in the back seat, and she said it when she was teaching me how to drive. Every stretch of highway or back road turn was different under the veil of darkness. I laughed at the concept at first, thinking maybe she was overreacting a little. I had just gotten my license, and I had driven many times before, but they had all been convenient daylight drives in the past. I thought, surely, as long as I had a GPS and working headlights, everything would be fine. In the end, her words rang true, and it was something I learned the hard way. My 18th birthday was 2 months ago. I was working a part-time day shift job as a dishwasher at a country club since I graduated from high school. It wasn't a bad job, and it taught me the value of earning and appreciating your paycheck. I found that, despite my hate for school, I actually enjoyed working and making money to provide for myself instead of just hanging around and existing. My mom or my sister would drop me off and pick me up after work in the family beater, an old Dodge Intrepid, so they could run errands and whatnot while I was at work. We didn't have a lot of money, and I was helping out around the house with what I made as a dishwasher. But that all changed when I ran into my cousin at the country club. He had offered me a job making twice as much at the place where he worked. My cousin Scott was a steel worker. It sounded exciting to me at the time. A dangerous job, farther away from home than I was used to, lots of overtime, and bigger checks. I didn't have any plans for college, and I didn't have anything else lined up employment-wise, so it seemed like a lifeline when he offered it to me. It would be my first big boy job, and I couldn't help but think of the dollar signs swirling through my head. "It'll be good for you," he said. "You can get an early start, make some good money, try to get things on track. Make it through probation, and you'll have a steady job to hunker down at for a bit." After an application, a ride to a job interview, and a drug test, I was on my way to doing just that. I would start as a laborer doing grunt work, and when a bid came up, I might have a chance to move into something a little more concrete. I put in my notice at the dish pit, bought some steel-toed boots and some heavy cargoes to wear until uniforms came in, and finished my 2 weeks with impatience. I would start out on a second shift, working 3 to 11, and probably get forced into some overtime, but I was cool with it. Once my 2 weeks were up, I said goodbye to the friends I had made at the country club and got ready for bigger and better things. With a new job starting, my mom said I would take the Intrepid myself, just in case I had to work way later than scheduled. She was worried about me being out so late, and more importantly, driving at night. The mill was in a port 20 miles away, whereas my previous job was just down the road. There were only two ways to get there: the expressway, which would get me there faster, or the back road that went through the dunes that led to the port. My mother said the highway was out of the question. Too many crazy people on the roads, and the fact I had never driven at night made her very uncomfortable. She said I would take the scenic route. It was covered in trees, and traffic was light, and I would be fine as long as I watched for deer. I was nervous and excited, but before I knew it, I was on my way to my first day. I plugged my phone in with the aux cord. Since my phone was an old hand-me-down, I had to find a sweet spot for it to come in clearly. I set my GPS and put on some music and started the heavily wooded cruise. On my way to work, the drive was beautiful. The trees were tall and danced in the wind, rays of sun shining down all the way to the port. It was a more touristy route, I suppose, being so close to the lake. Gift shops and gas stations could be seen every couple miles, and there were several elderly men taking their project cars out for a Sunday drive on a Monday. At the halfway point in my drive, I caught a red light. The intersection was small, with an old train station next to it with a sign that read, "Sandy Shores." There was a couple on a bench outside the station, cheesy smiles beaming as they posed for a selfie. It all seemed so serene, this beautiful drive, on the way to my much more profitable job, seeing these nice cars that maybe one day I would be able to afford. I looked forward to making this drive in the days to come. With my tunes playing on the stereo, a nice, easy speed limit, and lazily listing turns, I found my way to work and got to my first day. The port itself was the farthest thing from beautiful. It seemed like a decaying hole in the land, nothing but dusty gravel, loud semi-trucks, and louder bangs echoing from the factories on every corner. I parked next to the other soot-covered cars and headed in. After getting my own hard hat and being shown around, I was led to my station, where I would spend the next 8 hours putting bands on stacks of plates and verifying skid tickets. Some people were rougher than others, but the night shift seemed to be more populated with a younger crew, so I blended in just fine. I ended up with a guy named Terry, someone a few years older than me, who showed me the ropes and made sure I was out of people's way. He was a pretty cool guy, hardworking and priding himself on being an overtime hog. The job was a little stressful, but the banter in between packaged loads made it a little easier. Despite the intimidation of the overhead cranes and loud percussion of the machines, I focused on the tasks at hand and did the best I could. I wanted to impress management so I wouldn't get axed during my probation. The day seemed to fly by. Halfway through the shift, the supervisor let me know Terry and I were getting low man to stay over a few hours after the shift to pick up the warehouse. Something about cleaning up to install cameras for the line. Terry was pleased and said he would have volunteered anyway. It was seniority-based overtime, so if I wanted to keep my job, I didn't really have a choice. Even though the shift was extended, it went pretty quickly. The labor was way less monotonous than doing dishes all day. I was told I could wrap it up for the day and head home. Terry said he would stay and try to milk it a little longer, and after a fist bump, I punched out and it was time to go home. I was feeling extremely accomplished and optimistic. That was until I got to the parking lot. It was dark outside. Very dark. The parking lot was mostly empty, except for my car, Terry's, and the supervisor's. Out in the port, the air was chillier and more eerie than back home. It even felt darker, like I didn't belong there. Trying to maintain my high spirits, I walked to my car, which was now covered in the dust that blew around all day. I got in, started it up, and plugged my phone back into the aux so I could hear the GPS and music on my way home. I texted my mom that I was on my way, and after picking a song, I was ready to go. It shouldn't be too bad, I told myself, and as I pulled out of the parking lot, I prepared to cross another milestone in the same day, driving home at night. Leaving the port was just as different at night. Instead of the sun lighting everything up, there was just a row of orange lamps lighting the way out. A few semis were shouldered for the night, drivers who were sleeping to get the jump on the next load first thing in the morning. It seemed so desolate compared to earlier. As I drove through the exit and back on the scenic route that would take me back the way I came, I realized that the orange lights in the port would be the last of my light for a while. Once I left, it was just me on the road, my old beater car chugging away into the night. It wasn't too bad. The visibility was a little worse than I thought, but at least I had the GPS and music. The drive was only half an hour. Before I knew it, I would be back home and showering after my first long day at work. Entering the wooded portion of my drive felt like driving into a cave. The tall trees leaning over the road blocked out even the slightest hint of moonlight. I focused on the drive ahead, the worn aux input crackling over my music. Each bump in the road seemed rougher than before, each branch reaching just a little further in the headlights. I white-knuckled the wheel as I drove, feeling silly for being as on edge as I was. It was just a short drive. What was the big deal? Everybody drove at night. People did it all the time. Each winding curve seemed to turn into the same repetitive stretch of trees, like I was driving through the same segment over and over again. Time seemed to crawl as my car chugged down the road, the high beams reflecting off every sign as I made my way. Old, beat-up signs for no passing, signs warning of a low shoulder, signs for deer crossing. I looked at them all, one by one, my eyes lingering long on the yellow square with the silhouette of a buck prancing. Watch for deer. To my surprise, there wasn't much to watch out for, except for the trees. Just when I thought I wasn't making any progress, I found myself at the same intersection from earlier, caught at the same red light. I slowed to the inevitable stop and sat, waiting, my progressive rock drumming against long-blown speakers. My eyes drifted from the road in front of me to the train station, the sign for Sandy Shores not lit with a flickering neon. The bench with the couple I observed earlier now stood empty under a lamppost, littered with discarded trash from the commuters throughout the day. There wasn't a soul in sight. No other cars, nobody else making a trek somewhere in the middle of the night. It just felt so dark. I checked the GPS as I sat. I only had 12 minutes until I reached my destination. The drive was practically over already. As I looked down at my phone, I saw a green glow fill the cab as the light changed. I eased off the brake and continued. I thought of the work I did prior and how my muscles were sore in a way I had never felt before. My joints ached differently, like I had spent all day log rolling down a hill. I thought of a hot shower and washing away the dirt and rust that circulated through the air of the plant as the production line ran. As fulfilled as it made me feel, in the back of my mind, I wondered how people did something like that every day for work. I guessed I would just get used to it. Ahead, I saw a pothole in the headlights glow, one I wouldn't be able to swerve away from in time. The passenger side tire hit a dead center, the impact rocking the entire car on its shot suspension. I winced at the crater in the pavement, and the crackling in the music got worse as the aux lost its sweet spot. The grinding distortion stood my hair up as I reached for the cord and found nothing but an empty seat. I felt around for my phone in the dark, my fingers trying to trail the cord to the source. "Come on," I said, fumbling in the dark. After several attempts, I couldn't quite find the phone, like my hand wasn't making the connection to my brain about what it was supposed to be looking. I saw the eyes and the reflection of the fur too late, and I slammed on the brakes. The tires squealed as I flew toward the baby deer, my entire body seizing like a frozen statue. I could only squeeze the steering wheel and stomp my foot as hard as I could, unable to totally alter the momentum of the car. I stopped suddenly, but not fast enough, the car screeching to a halt just late enough to smack the fawn with the front bumper. The hit was quick, but solid, and I watched in denial as the young animal was tossed off its hooves and tumbled down the road in front of me. I gritted my teeth so hard they hurt. I looked at the body, dumbfounded. It had happened so fast. There was no way it could just come out of nowhere. I didn't have enough time. Even if I wasn't distracted, there was no way I could have... How was I supposed to... The static was worse through the stereo. My phone was lost somewhere in the abyss that was the passenger side floor. The cord had followed it, and it hung from the jack at a sharp angle like a tugged fishing line. I sat there with my jaw hanging, unsure of what to do, unsure of what to think. Before I had the time to even process what had happened, ahead of me, another bright shape echoed in the headlights. Another deer with big ears and a shiny coat had walked into the road slowly, like it couldn't believe what it was seeing. With hesitant steps, it crossed the pavement, and as I painstakingly watched it nudge the motionless body with its snout, I came to the horrifying conclusion of what I was looking at. Its mother. Ahead of me, the majestic, plump doe nudged the still corpse of its child, and as it registered what it had found, promptly erupted into the saddest cries of pain I have ever heard from an animal. With its head whipping around in desperation, it called out to the woods surrounding us, its baying echoing through the trees and chilling me to the bone. Its loss, the emotion it felt, was brought on by me, and the guilt washed over me like a smothering plague. I couldn't think. I could only watch. I watched helplessly, wanting to do something, but the cruel realization settled quickly. What could I possibly do? Other than run down its child, how could I possibly help the situation I had caused? From the passenger floor, my phone struggled against its lack of proper connection. The grinding static was worse and assaulted my ears, but I didn't dare look for my phone now. I could only look ahead at the grieving doe and the child I'd run down. I thought about calling someone, maybe calling my mom, but then what? She would be asleep, and when she woke up, there would be a cataclysmic uproar. And even then, I had the only car. It's not like she could come get me. I swallowed hard, and after what felt like an eternity of mulling it over, I decided the only thing my piece of shit self could do in a situation like this. I would try to go around them and drive away. I felt the tears welling in my eyes and my nose starting to run as I readjusted my grip. My foot was still stuck against the floor, so I started easing off the brake, committing to my decision to flee. Before I could let off, however, I heard a faint tap on my window. When I turned that way, my blood went cold. Staring at me was a giant set of glass-like eyes, belonging to a large 18-point buck. With wide, bulky shoulders, it stood in the entirety of the oncoming lane, hunched down so it could look through my window. Its antlers reached far from the sides of its head, each pronounced point bulbous with velvet. After a deep inhale, it snorted into the chilly air, fogging the glass that seemed so thin under its size. The dark pupils were entrancing and terrifying, like the inside of the car was shrinking under their gaze. I'm sorry. I didn't mean... It just happened. I'm sorry. I mumbled to the large stag, my hands shaking on the wheel. Swirling fear pulled at my gut, and I felt like I was going to piss myself if I didn't look away. For only a second, I looked at the doe and its child in front of me, my sense of flight wondering if I could chance it and take the shoulder off-road and get past them. The groaning ox continued on the floor, the cord begging to be adjusted or pulled free altogether. I looked at the giant deer in desperation, wanting to apologize more, but knowing it would be useless. Only when it raised its head did I realize it wasn't looking at me, but past me to the other side of the car. I followed its gaze and saw another of the herd had crept up, a younger male from the looks of it, two little velvet points sticking from its head. It investigated the car as it walked up, timidly observing the shape of the car before looking inside. It looked at me, then at the elder, exchanging an unsettling, silent glare on opposite sides. As I was caught in the middle, the doe ahead let out another pained wail. The great deer exhaled again, spreading the fog on the window. It tipped its nose to the younger deer, and I watched as it fluttered its ears. The younger one started looking into the car, its head panning the interior as the older one watched. The static on the radio came in and out, like a radio station tuning. After a moment, it paused and stared at something in the dimly lit cab. It didn't make sense to me. On my left, the elder was looking at the same thing. At first, I thought it was the dash, but they weren't quite looking at that. Slowly, I realized it wasn't the glow of the radio they were transfixed on. They were looking at the keys. In a fit of panic, I reached for the switch next to me and locked the doors. A second later, the younger deer lowered its head and hooked one of its nubs on the door handle and jerked up, trying to work the latch. The knocks of the handle slapping were loud, and I jumped. The larger deer snorted angrily. It looked at the lock on the windowsill in a way that I could only explain as pure anger. I blindly felt for my phone again and was painfully reminded it was still on the floor. The radio crackled as I fumbled with the cord, and I could swear I could hear words over the frequency. It was barely audible, but I swore it sounded like, "Let us in." The larger deer stared at me again, and without warning, smacked its antlers on the window. I jumped at the sound of it, and I prayed to God that the glass would hold. I looked forward again at any possible route to drive away. With them boxing me in, I would have no choice but to swipe one of them or run into the mother directly. The larger one smacked the window again, this time busting the velvet, leaving a gritty red splotch on the fogged glass. It dragged it across the window, making a dark smear as the bony point scraped along. Ahead, the doe rested its head on its still offspring, its chest heaving with human-like crying. Tears streaked down its fur, and at the sight of it, it was like I could hear the sobbing inside the car over the radio. "Let us in, or let him in." I tried to reach for my phone again. I chanced to glance at the floor, and I could see the outline of it in the far corner. I gently pulled on the aux cord, and the distortion worsened with every tug, assaulting my ears. I tried to turn off the radio, but it wouldn't work. The volume and source buttons only yielded the same digital error message on the display. The larger deer was rattling its rack against the window faster now, a bleeding mess trailing behind the shedding velvet. The younger deer pressed the side of its face against the passenger side window, its dark eyeball pressing against the glass as it tried to look in as closely as it could. The mother deer's crying could be heard over the radio. There was a menacing chorus rising in the static, something that was trying to push through. The human crying was so loud it was like a woman sobbing in the back seat, sobbing in my ear. I looked at the window with the larger deer, with the array of bloody streaks. And as the streaks seemed to take shape, the crying and the chorus grew louder. The streaks weren't just random nudges. It was drawing something. It was drawing a pentacle. With the last crude stroke that completed the crimson star and circle formation, there was a fog rising from the ditch on the side of the road. The mother buried her face into the lifeless fawn like it was trying to hide. Now that the crying had subsided, the chorus seemed clearer, and it hit me that it wasn't singing or anything like it. It was screaming. Horrible, tortured screams. Through the billowing fog, A wicked amalgamation of antlers jutted from the damp leaves and grass. With bright red rays, it tore through the earth, the sounds of 100 screaming souls droning over the radio as the rack poked through. The volume on the radio kept turning up. I covered my ears to thwart the punishing sound. The deer, on both sides of me, just stared at my anguish, the sound rising to a pitch so great I thought the windshield would shatter. As the deer stared, I could see their faces begin to shake like a movie stuck on fast forward. Their eyes rattled in their skulls as their faces blurred, the speakers in the car whining under the strain of hopeless cries and pleas. The phalanx of antlers gave way to fur, wrapped around a skull bigger than a moose. Through the cold mud, it steamed in its ascent. Whether it was torn velvet or strips of flesh hanging from its points, I wasn't sure. They dangled like drying strips of meat. Beside me, the deer shook so fast their features distorted, some of them animal, others human. It matched the screams coming through the radio. As the full bust of shiny black fur came through the ground, the fog wisped away as if on fast forward as well. The head of the giant deer opened its eyelids to reveal two bleeding spheres the size of baseballs, its jet black pupils narrowing in on me, cowering behind the steering wheel. I closed my eyes, wondering when I had started to scream. My scream blended with the others, one and the same. The screaming stopped. I sat there with my hands over my ears, my eyes squeezed shut, afraid to open them again. I heard the snort once again, and it was a moment before I gave in and looked in its direction. The large deer was still there, but it wasn't looking at me anymore. The screaming was gone, the bloody pentagram was gone, the mysterious fog and the shadowy black deer were gone. I lowered my hands to see the younger buck was looking away as well, its ears fluttering with excitement. Not only were they not looking at me, they were walking away. Ahead of me, the fawn I had hit just minutes ago was blinking awake, confused and disoriented. After a struggle, it stumbled to its feet with the help of its mother and weakly stood on its own after a few licks and prods with her nose. The large buck snorted and nodded at the baby, and after a moment of consideration, it nodded back. The large male gave an approving snort and turned to the mother, who nodded as well. I watched them in silence, not even sure what to do anymore. All at once, they looked at me, a family of four, their many glassy eyes reflected in the headlights. I put my hands up in defeat. I couldn't help but stare back, my hands shaking as they huddled closer together. With a snort, the large male nodded, once at me, then once to the open road behind them. I didn't believe it. Slowly, they moved together, giving me enough room to drive past them. I hesitated, but not for long. As soon as there was enough room, I let off the brake and started driving, creeping past the family herd as they watched me go. I gave an apologetic look at the baby, who returned it with twinkling eyes. As soon as I was clear of them, my foot pressed the accelerator and I got the hell out of there. Even though I was clear, I couldn't help but look in the rearview mirror behind me to make sure they weren't chasing me. I wish I would have just kept my eyes forward instead of behind me. They watched me go in silence, their dead stares unblinking as my car got further and further away. Just as they were almost out of view, they stood up on their hind legs, one by one, until they were all upright with their front legs at their sides. The mother and fawn walked away first, with the younger buck following close behind. The father stayed, however. His stare followed, until all I could see was an open stretch and trees behind me. You've been listening to Watch for Deer by Jesse Pullins. Next, roll down the windows and turn up the volume for Neon Nightmare. Palm trees passed in a blur as Roger leaned back in his seat, cigarette held tight in his lips. He flicked open his Zippo and tried to light it, shielding both sides as the flame burned erratically despite his best efforts. He got it going, barely, scorching his beard in the process. I glanced in amusement as he sat up, dilated eyes peering over his aviators as he puffed the cherry to life. With a chuckle, he tucked the lighter in the pocket of his white suit jacket and readjusted his glasses. I shifted up, feeling the car growl under the pedal as the needle climbed.
"I gotta say, Warren, this shit is good," he said, taking a big drag and exhaling it to the wind.
"Yeah, it is," I said, as I gripped the steering wheel, admiring the glow of the setting sun ahead.
"No, man, I'm serious. I mean, look at this," he said,
running his hands over the suit jacket and floral button-up combo. The collar popped.
"This could be a new look for us. This is some next-level shit. I could get used to this."
He clapped a hand on my shoulder excitedly before reaching into his jacket. He pulled out a cassette tape, his eyebrows raising behind the glasses, cigarette held in a crooked grin. He popped the tape in and cranked up the volume before sinking back into his seat. A nostalgic 80s banger started playing, an electric tune to match the racing speed of the Corvette. He was right. The glow hitting the sunglasses, the blazers and button-up shirts, the roaring 85 convertible on a stretch of road into the horizon. It felt better than anything else we'd done before. It felt right, like we were meant to be here. It felt like vacation. I worked the pedals and shifted up again, letting my hand rest on the stick as I left it in fourth gear. The music got louder the faster we went, and I couldn't help but smile as the wind tossed my hair. It felt good to breathe, like my chest was getting lighter. It was a soothing feeling that stretched from my chin to my groin. Even at the increasing speed, I was starting to loosen up. I looked at Roger, who was slapping the door to the rhythm, cigarette burning brightly as he finished it off. "Raj, you good?" I asked. He tossed the butt to the wind and nodded. Some of his hair had matted to his forehead with the same cold sweat I felt through the desert air. He took off his shades and wiped his brow. His pupils were the size of olives. He undid the top two buttons of the Hawaiian shirt, the breeze lapping at his exposed chest hair.
"I'm good, brother, I'm good. How about you?"
he shouted over the wind. When he looked away from me, his eyes rested on the sun. I followed his gaze to the skyline and found myself lowering aviators as well. The setting orange rays that beamed across the desert highway started painting in a new light, the orange fading, no, bleeding, into pink. The colors melted to the brighter shade, casting a vibrant filter over every passing cactus and rock. The sun burned like a blazing neon star, the surrounding clouds echoing its incandescence across the sky. Down the ever-expanding stretch of road, the lines started to run together. Roger put his sunglasses back on, the lenses now bright bronze. Through the ecstasy of controlling my own breathing, I mouthed the only words I could muster. "Holy shit." The world shifted before me, its bold clarity bringing a sense of heightened awareness. I looked at the head of a passing palm tree and watched its leaves dance frame by frame. It was like watching an old movie, and when I turned back to the wheel, I would once again hear the rumble of the Corvette eating the pavement. I was reminded of Roger's presence by his laughter, his hair wild from the wind, his laughing booming with magnified pitches. There was a rising commotion over the sound of the radio, and we were pulled from our vivid distraction of the passing environment. It was the high-pitched rev of a motor, and I looked in the rearview mirror to see a single headlight gaining on us. It was the iconic scream of a crotch rocket motorcycle, and it was coming up fast. Roger swiveled in his seat and watched the rider approach with fascination. The motorcycle caught up and matched our speed, tailgating us for a moment before swinging around to pass. Through the view of the side mirror, I watched the rider advance, their jet-black bike revving until it was coasting parallel with us. Together, we turned to look at who it was, Roger lowering his glasses as I hid behind mine. They looked back, their helmet and visor matching the same gloss as the bike they leaned on as they kept up. They were garbed in full riding gear, skin-tight leather showing the undeniable curves of a feminine frame. Roger and I exchanged looks and promptly shrugged before turning back to her. My first thought was that she wanted to race. I edged the gas pedal provocatively, and Roger hooted and pumped his fist. As the slowly darkening pink landscape blurred around us, the rider only stared, their only expression my own animated reflection in their visor. When they did respond, they shook their head, strands of freshly permed hair tossed by the wind. She flicked her head backwards, nodding to the road behind us.
Warren?
Roger said cautiously, already looking before I had the chance. The rider turned ahead and, with the crank on the throttle, she sped off, leaving me to look at what was behind us. I watched in the rearview mirror and felt an unexplainable tightening in my gut, like an irrational fear was taking hold. My lack of comprehension of the pursuer made me incredibly anxious. Just seeing it made me uncomfortable. Behind us was what looked to be a man, but from the appearance, he was made entirely of tar. It appeared that he was running in place, but every step was connected to what looked like a pool of black paint. The way they moved was jerky and unnatural, like a mannequin. Every step was yanked from the oily substance, only to be sucked back into it over and over again. Even as the Corvette reached 100, it was not only keeping up, it was getting closer. I couldn't explain why, but just by seeing it, I knew it was hostile. It wanted to hurt us. We could feel it.
"Don't let it get close," I said,
and Roger nodded. Behind us, the figure was getting closer, only 2 car lengths away now. I looked in the mirror and saw it staring at me, bloodshot eyes locked onto mine in the mirror's reflection. There was something else to it. Even though its mouth wasn't moving, we could hear it, like it was speaking to us. It was more like a silent scream, a muted whisper in our head that was beaming at us with its tired, unmoving eyes. 1 car length away. It was looking at Roger now, its silent hostility growing as he reached behind the seat and pulled the sawed-off Mossberg pump. Holding the pistol grip to his hip, he repositioned in his seat and worked the slide, checking the breech to make sure it was loaded. Once the pursuer saw this, it got much louder, its silent screams clear enough to understand now. It just repeated the same phrase, maliciously, and in all the glow and distortion of this neon world, my hair stood on end.
"Just a taste. Just a taste. Just a taste."
It looked at Roger, and, without warning, it dove at him, inky black strands keeping it tethered to the black slime pool it stood on. Roger pulled the trigger. A ball of fire shot from the shotgun's muzzle, the blast of double-aught buck tearing through its shoulder and neck. In an awkward tumble, it fell to the blur of pavement, limbs breaking and scraping into the road as the tendrils pulled it back to the mass. Roger ejected the spent shell to the wind and steadied himself against his seat, watching in disbelief as more emerged from the black streak. Some men, some women, they materialized already running, almost thrashing out of the streak competitively. They shoved and pushed off each other, all the while keeping their gaze on me and Roger. The same menacing chant echoed from their tired, dead eyes.
"Just a taste. Just a taste. Just give us a taste."
"Get us out of here, Warren!"
shouted Roger, the gun bucking in his hand as he fired at the closest one. The pellets tore through the crazed face of a female pursuer. She faltered, only to be elbowed out of the way so another could replace her. The road ahead did nothing but stretch to the horizon, the neon sun dominating the sky. The only way out was forward. With the scattered palms and cacti, going off-road would only mean death. I buried the pedal to the floor, hoping we could outrun them. The rear end bounced as one pounced on the car, sharp liquid fingers puncturing the trunk. Roger raised the 12-gauge and removed one of its arms, and it flailed to stay on. As its legs grated into asphalt, another tried climbing it like a ladder. The next blast went through both of them, my ears ringing from the gunfire. They tumbled off the car, several behind, tripping over their rolling bodies, immediately to be replaced by more. Despite their animosity, they worked together as one, each of them shouting and reaching for the car.
"Just a taste.
Give us a taste.
They're not stopping,
yelled Roger, and I looked to see the thrashing mob of them almost reaching the car, no matter how fast I tried to go. As the 80s banger rang from the speakers, Roger cut them down as fast as he could, but there were always more. He worked the pump again to find his gun empty, and he tossed it away. He reached inside his suit jacket and pulled a pistol, then tried to aim against the beating wind. He looked down the sights only to see one leaping for him, its head reared back, inky strands separating as its mouth opened. He pulled the trigger and it spat in his face, a steaming burst of goo covering his aviators and forehead. He started screaming immediately, and I watched as his sunglasses started melding to his face.
My eyes! My fucking eyes!
His gun clattered to the floor as he turned in his seat, fingers curled as he clawed at the mess that seemed to be spreading. The rear end of the vehicle bucked again, this time a thumping slapping the wheel well. It sounded like a flat tire. It happened again on the other side. Trying to keep the car straight, I looked at them again and felt my stomach sinking away. They were throwing themselves into the wheels.
Just a taste.
They dove headfirst into the tires, their bodies wrapping and liquefying in a self-sacrificial oil slick. I lost traction as the tires spun free, flinging wet bits of them like half-dried paint. I let off the gas and tried to slow down, but the tires smoked and spun freely. I could feel their bodies whipping around beneath us, wrapping around the drive shaft, bogging us down however they could.
Hang on!
I shouted, fighting to stay straight as the wheels failed me. We slid out of control, the wheels locking as they clogged the axles with their destroyed bodies. Roger screamed and clawed at his face, and in the whirlwind of madness, I could see his eyes melting, the black goo bubbling and eating away. We spun several times, tires squealing and smoking, the vibrant colors running together. I saw the incoming tree in slow motion, and everything went black.
Warren? Warren, where are you? I hear them coming. I can't see.
I opened my eyes to hazy double vision. Engine smoke and dust burned my sinuses. The steering wheel jammed horribly in my stomach. I could hardly breathe. My body felt bruised and broken from head to toe. I could see the palm tree and the twisted metal of the Corvette wrapped around it. My vision recalibrated slowly, and I tried to move, but I was stuck. I could hear squirming, sizzling, groaning.
Raj? Raj, where are you at?
I called, coughing against the smoke in my lungs. I moved one of my arms and felt the sting of cutting glass.
I'm over here, pal. Help me! I hear them coming!
I could see him now, the details coming in with the same slow frames. He was on the ground in front of me, his suit torn, a bloody mess. He had gone through the windshield. I saw them there, inching closer. I tried to feel for the gun, but I could hardly move. The only thing my hands could find was glass and pain. Ahead, Roger looked blindly, a corroded cavity serving as his eyes.
I can't see you, Warren. I hear them coming. They're gonna get me. They're gonna...
The shadowy figures descended on him, and I could only watch helplessly. They ripped at his legs, tearing at his skin and cutting him deep. They tore open his stomach, his screams getting louder and hitching as they pulled his entrails from his body. The horrible sounds seared my mind. I felt the sadness work up bile from my gut. They cut and slashed. Dark red splatters stained the sand. An inky hand ripped off his bottom jaw, and after tossing it away, put its hands together and started to force its way down his throat. The horrible gurgling, the screams fading as it slithered in. As they consumed Roger, some of the stragglers started looking at me and decided it was my turn. Their bloodshot eyes were wild, their teeth jagged and broken. The first one leapt at me, claws outstretched, inky mouth opening.
Just a taste!
With a deafening blast, its head exploded, and its body writhed in the sand helplessly. With the sound of breaking glass and the whoosh of flame, the group feasting on Roger was engulfed in fire, neon orange tongues lapping around them. I looked up to see the bike rider, arm extended post-throw, and in her other hand, the largest handgun I had ever seen. The remaining monsters bolted at her, and with a practiced, aggressive stance, she brought her hands together and raised the weapon. The Desert Eagle barked like a cannon, every shot well-placed and decimating. She leaned into it as she shot, putting down each of them without hesitation. As the last one screamed inches away, she stuffed the bulky barrel into its mouth, the blast splashing the black goo all over the helmet's visor. They were gone. She moved toward me, ejecting a wide magazine that thudded in the sand. She pulled another from a holster on her thigh and slammed it home, racking the slide as she watched the smoldering fire that was Roger's grave. She reached her hands up and removed the helmet, releasing the cascade of curls it contained. She looked at me, her eyes alert and mesmerizing, her skin a smooth, deep tone. She walked with grace, each step bouncing her wide, styled hair. She holstered the gun and offered a hand to help me. With my arm weak and shaking, I reached for it. I blink to see a dirty, molding ceiling, and I'm hit by the clear, gut-wrenching stillness of sobriety. My eyelids are heavy and drag across my retinas like gravel. I cough dryly, my breath a fog in the chilly room. The coughing leads to hacking, and as I shiver and convulse on the dirty couch, I am painfully reminded of where I am. I look around the dim, derelict house. Its cobwebbed walls feel like they're closing in on me. My head throbs, and I wrap my frail arms around myself, trying to keep warm in my stained sweatshirt. I want to curl up in a ball and sleep on the couch, but it's the sight next to me that stops me. Roger sits next to me in a recliner, his mouth held still and open.
Raj? Raj, you awake?
I say between coughs, my raspy voice a whisper in the damp room. His mouth agape, I see the black fluid, thick and caked in his scraggly beard and unkempt mustache. The stain is splashed all over his neck and chest and has long since dried, like it happened hours ago. His eyes are closed, and his face is pale, almost white. I nudge him, even though I know in the back of my mind that he's already dead. I want to cry, but my eyes are too dry. I look at him, perfectly still, frozen in the chair. His hands were stuffed in the front pocket of his hoodie, the same thing he always did when he used. His hair is tangled and greasy. His lips are scarred, and his teeth, the ones he has left, are decayed and misshapen. We'd only been squatting together for a few weeks, but I feel his loss like the death of a brother. He looks peaceful, but I get a glimpse of pink and black, and for a second, I hear his screams. I rub my eyes, and they fade away. In front of me is a coffee table, covered in dust and garbage. There's a battery-powered boombox, weakly trying to play a cassette that ran out of tape hours ago. It was Roger's. Next to it is the score, the little plastic bag that brings back memories of days prior. I'm painfully reminded of the struggle it was to get it. 2 days panhandling, a shady backdoor deal behind a bar called the Sixth Shot, with a new subordinate we'd never heard of before. We squatted in the first hole in the wall we could find, a safe place to use away from the eyes of cops. We bought 4. I took 1. Roger took 2. I see the little black pill hiding in the plastic bag like the devil himself. I grab the little baggie and feel the pill between my fingers. As I touch it, I hear the music, see the palm trees and the bright neon sun. I tuck it in my pocket. I shut off Roger's boombox and eject the tape. I pocket that too, It will be the only thing to remember him by once my own mind is rotted away. I set his boombox in his lap, and with a solemn pat on the shoulder, I leave him there, just as we had done time and time again to the ones we've met along the way. I have no phone, and even if I did, I've burned every bridge long ago of the ones I would call. And even if I did tell someone, they wouldn't care. With a shiver, I duck out of the abandoned house and return to the dark, messy streets of the city. There's an anxiety welling in my gut, and as the cars pass, I feel into my pocket for the little plastic bag. The feeling is sickening, the same feeling every time. Through the screams that echo in my head, I find some peace in the little black pill as I roll it between my fingers. Deep down, I already know I have to go back, just to have one more taste. You've just heard Neon Nightmare by Jesse Pollins. And lastly, here's my last house blessing. I've been blessing houses for 3 years. 3 years of distressed parents, shaking kids, and superstitious elderly. From bumps in the night to shapes in the woods, I've answered calls far and wide to clear the terrified of their fear of the supernatural. I started small, in my hometown, and slowly worked my way to taking jobs out of state. I did it for free at first, but after the donations started rolling in and my name got around, I was able to earn a decent living from saving the innocent from otherworldly threats. My growth in popularity led to my persona, the young and prestigious Father Kane. I maintained a dedicated online presence, building groups and pages on social media to stay engaged with the community, answering every question, responding to every text. Each successful blessing brought more follows and shares. Before I knew it, Father Kane was a household name, and I was booked daily for months to come. My hair was gelled right, my pencil-thin beard immaculate, professional. I dressed clean and drove even cleaner, rolling up to houses in my waxed Cadillac DeVille and knocking on doors in black lambskin gloves. Every time an old man or frightened woman would call, I would deliver. Every ghost banished and aura lifted, soothing the minds around me. Each time, they would ask me how I performed such miracles, and each time, with over-exaggerated theatrics and heavy mysticism, I kept them from learning my hidden secret. I'm a fraud. That's right, I'm a total fake. It started as a prank, just to see if I could do it, really. But after I actually got away with it, I realized I could help people by the power of placebo alone. Built upon my own arrogant skepticism, I cloaked myself as a warrior of light, and boy was I welcomed with open arms. With just a bit of innovation, I put on a front that sold anyone at the end of their rope. Some well-versed scripture, sprinkled with buzzwords, a cheap rosary from Amazon, scuffed with sandpaper for authenticity. A vial of holy water, courtesy of the tap. I plan each blessing accordingly, using the information gathered beforehand. I go in and put on a good show, leaving the family feeling rejuvenated with their newly cleansed house. I've had nothing but success over the years, and my social media is filled with nothing but praise and delightful reviews. Over 100 successful cleanses, with nothing but thanks to follow. That was until yesterday. Yesterday, I blessed a house, and I will never do it again. Yesterday started like any other routine job. After some messaging back and forth with a client on Facebook, I knew the gist of what was going on. The client's name was Lacey Stevens, and she was concerned about some strange occurrences going on in her house. The same stuff I'd heard 100 times before. Unexplained noises, a chilly draft in the house, doors opening and closing on their own. The more significant detail was an apparent leak in the basement, some kind of ooze seeping from the foundation. My guess was septic. I decided before I went that the issue would be solved in the basement, the discovered origin from which the problem stemmed. In and out, no big deal. I pulled my car into the driveway, taking in their gorgeous property as I parked in front. It was an old Victorian-style house, a few acres of forest serving as a backdrop. A field neighbored the property on either side, and less than a block away was construction for what looked like a new subdivision. I stepped out of the car and walked up the drive, smoothing my peacoat with my shiny black gloves. In my right pocket was the rosary, and in the left was a bundle of sage with the vial of holy water. I went over my lines in my head, a smug grin already starting to form. "Lovely evening, Miss Stevens." "Blessed day, Miss Stevens. How are we faring today, Miss Stevens?" I stood at the front door, re-teased my hair, and raised my hand to knock. Before my knuckles could rap, the door shot open. "Good afternoon, Miss..."
"Jesus, you look more ridiculous than I thought."
A man stood in the door, tall and broad, his face twisted in a scowl. Wife beater, basketball shorts. On his head was a large gaming headset, a thin cord trailing down from it to a controller gripped in his hand.
"I'm sorry?"
I asked, confused. The man eyed me up and down and scowled again.
"Look here, pal, I don't know what kind of shit you're trying to sell to my wife, but do me a favor. Make this quick, let her down easy, and get the f—"
He was cut off by a much shorter woman who shoved past him.
"Father Kane, thank you for coming out today," said
Lacey Stevens, who beamed under the man's shadow. She was very pretty, with long brown hair and a curvy body accentuated by a spaghetti string top and leggings. "Pleasure's mine," I said, shaking her hand with both of mine, much like a priest would in a church. I flashed a smile at her, and then to the husband, who proceeded to groan.
"Come in, come in. Don't mind my husband, he's in the middle of a game."
She motioned inside, and the husband shambled away, his slides dragging on the floor. He sat on the couch, giving me another warning look, before unmuting his headset. On the wall opposite the couch was a large flat screen displaying a Call of Duty queue.
"Sorry, guys, I'm back.
Lacey actually invited that Chris Angel guy." "Would you like some tea?"
she asked, heading to the kitchen.
"That sounds wonderful," I said, watching her go.
I looked around the living room at the furnishings and wall decorations. It gave the old house a much more modern look, your standard live, laugh, love, giving a taste of Instagram home happiness. I looked at the pictures on the walls, taking in additional information in my head. Young couple, bubbly wife, stubborn husband, no kids, no pets. Should be easy, as long as the husband doesn't heckle too much. It wasn't my first time dealing with a skeptic, and it wouldn't be the last. We exchanged looks for a moment, him taking the time to remind me he didn't approve while his character sprinted through smoke. Luckily, Lacey returned quickly.
"I put the kettle on. So how do we start?"
she asked.
"Tell me about what's happening here, and we'll go from there," I said, putting my hands together.
"It started a couple of months ago. Nothing really crazy, just weird. I've had a couple of doors close on their own while he's at work. Sometimes in the middle of the night, the house creaks, and I can hear scratching in the walls. It didn't happen often at first, but lately it's been every night. My husband thinks I'm overreacting. Not that he would hear it anyway, the way he snores,"
she said, her eyes traveling like she was searching for something invisible. "I see. Sometimes darkness works in mysterious ways, Mrs. Stevens. The devil always looks to bend the ear of those willing to listen," I said, pulling the rosary from my pocket. Behind us, the husband scoffed. Lacey gave an annoyed look past me and motioned toward the kitchen.
"Most of the activity is in the kitchen and the basement. The entrance to the basement is next to the pantry."
"Let's have a look, shall we? I want to reach the epicenter. It'll be where we'll cast our blessing, if that is what you want,"
I said, letting the beads unravel until the cross dangled in the air. She went to turn, and I put a hand up to stop her.
"What? Is something wrong?"
she asked, eyes wide and worried.
"Ah, yes. There is definitely a presence in your house. I can feel it now, and it beckons from the basement. The devil's dark touch reaches out, and I believe..."
All right, cut the theatrics,"
the husband cut in, his headset and controller left on the couch.
"Just let her show you the damn basement so we can get this over with."
He brushed past me and stood next to his wife protectively, she gave an apologetic look. Of course, let us see the basement, I said with a smile. Bumps in the night were a common occurrence. Every chilling noise mistaken for a haunting could easily be debunked by rational thought and a bit of research. Creaks in the night were always an old house settling on the earth it was built upon. Scratching in the walls was most likely squirrels, flying squirrels, with the sheer amount of wooded land in this town. Doors that closed on their own were usually all chalked up to overall gravity and pressure changes in the rooms themselves. In conclusion, old country houses doing old country house things. Not that I would tell them that. What sort of noises have you been hearing, Mrs. Stevens? I asked, following them in slow, steady steps. I felt it helped in the act. Lacey turned to acknowledge, while her husband rolled his eyes and waited with impatience. The scratching has only happened a couple of times. There's been knocks, too. Sometimes I think I hear whispers also, she said, rubbing her arm as if suddenly chilled. Varmints, old plumbing, perhaps a forgotten television. The most unnerving one is the clicking, though. I can't explain it. It almost sounds like gunfire, she said, looking at her husband. I told you, Lacey, nobody's firing off machine guns in the neighborhood. We live in a nice part of town. Here's the basement. Come on, said the husband, rushing the tour along. Machine guns? I entered the kitchen and actually felt a chill waft over me. I could see the culprit immediately, a pair of single-pane windows by the sink. I kept my smile to myself and followed the husband, the wife following close behind. The husband opened the door next to the pantry to reveal the dark entrance to the basement. With a sigh, he reached into the dark and flicked the light switch, and the stairway filled with soft yellow light. "It's down here. Watch your step, Copperfield," he taunted. "Of course. This is where the energy is manifesting. Would we like to say a prayer before we head down?" I asked, and Lacey considered. "No, I don't want to deal with this all day. Let's get it done," he said.
"Brian, don't be a dick," Lacey said.
"It's quite all right. The Lord is with me now, every step of the way," I said, looking down the old wooden steps. "Sure, sure. Don't hit your head," Brian led. We went down the stairs, each step creaking as we descended. The basement was unfinished, the crude cement walls damp and dimly lit. Lacey passed us and went to the old washer and dryer, her bare feet slapping the concrete floor. There were two green rugs on the floor, one in front of the machines and another in the far corner. "This is where I hear it, every time I do laundry. He thinks I'm crazy." She put her arms out in the empty space. "Hear what, exactly?" I asked.
"The clicking," she said.
"Probably just a jackhammer or something. They're putting in that new neighborhood. I'm sure you saw the construction," Brian said.
"It's only when I'm down here, alone," she said, hugging herself.
I hadn't heard of any clicking in the past. An old clock, sure, but a sound as fast as a jackhammer? That was a new one for me. I walked over to the closest wall, running a gloved hand over the bricks. "You said there was a leak. May I see it?" I asked. Lacey walked over to the second rug and peeled it up. It separated from the ground with a wet sucking sound, and I moved closer to inspect it. Septic leak would be anywhere from clear to brown, not to mention the smell. This leak was black, like the color of tar. Underneath the rug was a wooden padlocked door, and the black ooze had been seeping from underneath it. "I had a guy check out the septic. We should be good now," Brian said.
"That was 2 days ago. It's leaking again," said Lacey.
"Then I'll call him again." I looked at the trap door and the rusted lock, which looked like it hadn't been touched in a decade. I could feel a breeze coming from it, like a damp breath pushing out. There was something about the door. It didn't feel right. I looked at it, feeling my ears get hot. The longer I looked, the more I thought I heard something. Something slowly rising beneath it. I clutched the rosary nervously, the sound getting louder.
"The kettle,"
Lacey said, and made her way upstairs. I chuckled, always an explanation. We watched her go, and when she was out of sight, Brian narrowed his eyes on me.
"We finished here. come on, man, don't drag this out, he said. What's with the door? I asked, pointing to it on the floor. It's a crawl space. Never seen one before? Why is it locked? I asked, crouching down to get a closer look at it, trying to look more concerned than necessary. I don't know, man. Realtor said it floods. The lock was there when we bought it. We just left it there. Covered it with a rug. It's pretty gross, he explained. Excellent. The realtor already explained it, so the only one concerned here was the wife. The husband already didn't want me here. He could give his blessing, feign some sense of clarity, and be on his way. Evil enjoys dark, damp seclusion, Mr. Stevens. It gives it an adequate place to hide, to fester. It burrows into the property and grows. The longer it's there, the more mischievous, more unrelenting it gets. I played it up, gently grabbing the lock. The surface of the rusted metal deteriorated on my gloves. I rubbed my fingers together, and it smeared into a disgusting paste. Do you believe in God, Mr. Stevens? I waited for an answer, but none came. No attitude, no jab, no sigh. Above me, the door slammed hard, and I jumped. I looked for Mr. Stevens, but he was gone. Standing alone in the basement, the lights went out. I sighed. I felt a chill on the back of my neck and chuckled to myself. So, this is how it was going to be. I felt through the dark, heading to the stairs. I cleared my throat and spoke aloud. I understand my presence here aggravates you, Mr. Stevens, but pranking me isn't the way to solve this matter, I said, my footsteps echoing on the old steps. I reached for the basement door and opened it, expecting them to be waiting, possibly laughing. Maybe they were playing me. But there was no laughter, no pointed fingers. There was nobody at all, just an empty, cold kitchen. Even the appliances were gone. Hello? I called, watching my words come out as fog. The house was bare and unbelievably gray. I walked into the kitchen, my footsteps kicking up dust. My first thought was to just leave, the irrational fear of the unknown gripping my spine like ice. I headed for the front door and shoved it open. My car was gone. The driveway was gone. Nothing but open fields. No construction. Nothing. The sky above was the color of ash, overcast for as far as you could see. Mrs. Stevens? Mr. Stevens? Hello? I called, but my voice barely reached. The sound wouldn't carry. It was being suppressed by something else. It was an odd noise, and my mind conjured the only thing to make sense of it. Clicking. There was movement in the monochrome landscape, about as far away as my car had been. Long, twig legs attached to white, elegant feathers. A pair of storks in the grass, their legs robotic under a seemingly fluid body. They looked at me, eyes beady and wide, as if they were alarmed. Their bodies contorted, long necks bending backwards in unison like they were dancing. Together, they pointed their beaks to the sky, a loud chattering erupting from their bills. It sounded like gunfire over the valley. I slammed the door to block out the noise and hide from their beady eyes. No, 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 I stammered, feeling helpless, out of control. The rosary in my hand was steaming, the beads radiating warmth. I looked around the living room. The flat screen, the couch, video games, all gone. Bare walls, fogged windows. There was a loud crash, and I squeezed my eyes shut, the rosary held close. Whatever it was, it came from the basement. Hello? Anybody there? I cried weakly. Over 100 houses, never anything out of the ordinary. This didn't make sense. It just wasn't possible. I stood there in denial for a time. I knew what I had to do, or rather, the only thing I could do. My feet moved on their own when they were ready. Slow, creaking steps, one by one. Back to the kitchen, the air getting colder as I moved. I shivered, the chill stiffening my peacoat. No hot burner, no piping kettle. My attention was drawn to the basement doorway. to the dark passage that seemed to push wind from it, like it was breathing. I went in, holding the beads close, pushing forward down the steps. I waited for something, like a hand to grab me, but the sensation was different. I felt eyes on me, but there was no one in sight. At the landing, I turned hesitantly, knowing what I would find, but afraid to see it. No washer and dryer, no rugs, only the cellar door, thrown wide open. The padlock and latch littered the floor in pieces. The dark hole beckoned, its mysterious black luring me in. I didn't want to go. It was something that just happened on its own. I could hear sounds coming from it, like someone was plucking a tight guitar string. It was metallic and wiry. I stood before the hole and looked in. There was nothing, only a void. Black so thick it looked like you could grasp it. The noises came from the hole, the metallic ting with a whisper on the cold breeze. Whatever it said, it didn't make sense. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy... A loud pop interrupted my mumbling, and I clutched my stomach in pain. It felt like someone had punched me. I felt the sensation of trickling water and assumed I pissed myself. But to my dismay, I did not. The leak was coming from my coat. I reached in to feel my glove soaking and pulled it out to find a handful of glass. The vial of holy water had burst. My mind raced. With a shaky hand, I tried to get all the glass out, wet shards hitting the concrete like pebbles. I kept trying to mumble, to say something in comfort, but the words felt scrambled in my head. The now wet bundle of sage tumbled out with the glass, and I watched it fall. As soon as it hit the floor, it shriveled, igniting in embers and a puff of smoke. God help me, I thought, the smoke stinging my eyes. I stepped in front of the hole, peering in like it was an open casket. I felt the wind, and there it was again, the metallic twine. I didn't have a choice. I had to go in. Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, I stammered. The irony was not lost on me. I was a joke. I deserved this. Holding the rosary, I closed my eyes and jumped in. Falling, endless black. I hugged myself, the wind flapping my cheeks as I yelled, plummeting into nothing. There was nothing but gusting wind, my stomach twisting as the blind momentum continued. I thought of prayers, something for comfort, but it didn't matter. Even if I could find the words, I didn't deserve to use them. Eventually, my shoes felt surface, softly at that. I landed gracefully at my destination, and once I had the courage, I opened my eyes. I was in what looked like a cavern, but a man-made one. Carved out 10-foot ceilings in the stone, like a larger, cruder basement. Torches lined the walls, fire that burned white. I wanted to call out, but my breath was ripped from my lungs. Whatever I was meant to see, I had found, and it was right in front of me. I watched in horror, unable to speak, unable to breathe, the sounds of metallic plucking clear as day. Hanging from the ceiling on a long braid of barbed wire was a woman. Blindfolded and gagged, she hung like an art piece, a complicated shibari tie forcing her pose upside down. Her naked skin was scuffed with a slick black rub, an oily substance that reflected the torchlight. She swayed slightly, the barbs tinking off other strands. It looked terrifying and painful, the way the wire bound her. Arms tied tight behind her back, each leg positioned individually with the grace of a ballerina, like she was twirling in the air. Through the horror of the bondage was a beauty, her figure displayed like a twisted sculpture. The rosary was hot in my hands, steaming against the lambskin glove. My fingers wouldn't let it go, like it was the only thing I had left. I could hear the sound again. The maddening clicking of the storks bouncing off the walls from some unknown location. I took a step toward the woman to try to help her,
but froze. A shape emerged from the shadows of the cavern, a broad figure garbed in what looked like layers and layers of leather. I could hear the fabric of their clothing as it moved. Whatever resided beneath was being restrained. I guessed it to be a muscular man from the build, but its face was shielded by a porcelain mask, arced slits for eyes, and a long shoebill beak. It looked like a plague doctor, but tainted. Behind the eyes of the mask, two globes glared, bloodshot and depraved. I could hear his breathing now, heavy and labored. The Dominator came to the woman's side, their hulking presence casting a shadow over the helpless pose. A leather hand moved across her body, sliding over the slick rub, caressing the breast. The woman writhed in her restraints, her whimpers indiscernible from pleasure or fear. The hand rested on her stomach, fingers tapping the skin like this was a carnival show. With a heavy step, their boot pressed into the floor, an indent in the stonework causing a groaning shift. The floor split apart, opening a pit beneath them. They floated in the center, a small platform serving as a stage. It was now that the noises got louder, reverberating so intensely they shook the walls and rattled my teeth. Dozens, no, hundreds, the chorus of clicking blasting from the pit. Below the stage, an army of wild-eyed storks clacked their beaks. They jumped excitedly, wings smacking each other as they reached for the bound woman. They didn't notice me there, every beady eye locked hungrily above. The masked man reached behind him, slowly, and the birds clicked in anticipation. Theatrically, he withdrew his hand, a long sickle shining in the white torchlight. The commotion grew as he placed the cold steel against her abdomen, and she twitched under its touch. After a pant of admiration, he pulled the blade fast, and her lean stomach separated. A geyser of black and red rained into the pit, and the Dominator let her go, her sculpture body spinning, her legs curled like a stork. Below, the birds went wild, clacking wet beaks at the splashing blood. They shoved and fought for it, stark white feathers stained a vibrant red in the light. It covered everything until all you could see was a writhing mess of beaks and claws. Their pupils dilated, and the clicking got erratic, unsynchronized. As she ran dry, the woman gave her final convulsion before going limp. In my hand, the rosary exploded. The sound was deafening, beads bouncing off the cavern walls like a shotgun blast. The squawking and clicking stopped, and all fell silent. Ahead of me, the hulking Dominator looked my way, a long finger unraveling from his fist as he pointed. Those bloodshot eyes looked angry, offended even. Like a sonic boom, the birds cried together, bursting from the pit like an erupting volcano. Red feathers, sharp beaks, eyes dotted like pinpricks. They were on me instantly, pecking and slashing with their extremities. They squawked in my ears before pecking at them. Their talons tore my clothes, ripped my coat. I felt the beaks puncture my scalp and knock my skull, a valley of spear-tipped stabs picking me apart. My flesh peeled away. Their solid beaks rattled against my bones.
Get off me! Get off! Get...
What the fuck is your problem, man? It was just a fuse, said a familiar voice. I thrashed wildly and opened my eyes, Lacey and Brian looking down at me, bewildered. We were back in the kitchen. I huffed for breath, sweat trickling down my back and beading on my forehead. At my feet was a shattered teacup, china glass crunching under my feet.
What? What happened?
I asked, taking off my gloves and wiping my face. I unbuttoned my peacoat. I was burning up. The beaks that tore my flesh, the holy water, sage, and rosary. I patted my pockets. They were empty.
What do you mean, what happened? The breaker blew and I went to fix it. You said you would burn some sage and sprinkle some water or whatever, said you'd be right up.
Brian said, his brow furrowed. Then you come up here, mumbling and shit, and she handed you some tea. You squeezed the cup until it broke, reached out for her, all crazy. Now look at this mess. What's wrong with you, man? My mind raced. I looked at Lacey, who put her hands up and backed away, moving behind Brian. I thought of it all. It replayed in my head on fast forward. The barbed wire, the girl, the storks. I looked at Lacey's face, the hair, her skin. It was her, the bound woman. I blinked and rubbed my eyes. My face was flushed, and I felt a hot trickle from my nose. I touched it to see the red drip of a nosebleed. "You need to get out of this house. It's not safe," I pleaded, and they flinched when I stepped forward. "You guys gotta go. I don't know what it is. I can't explain." Brian cut me off. "No, it's you who needs to go. Get the fuck out of here. Come on, let's go, now," he said, grabbing me by the arm, hard. "No, you don't understand. Your wife, she's not safe. You gotta get her out of here," I begged as he shoved me through the living room. "Yeah, not safe from you, no doubt." He opened the door and tossed me out, jabbing a finger in my face. "Don't come back here, understand? Don't message my wife, don't show your face here again. I'll call the cops, psycho." He slammed the door in my face. I walked to my car, my head foggy, my nerves shot. My hands were shaking, and when I got into my car, I sat there for a moment. I looked at the house with all of its color returned. I looked to the front window. Lacey was there, mouthing the words, "I'm sorry," briefly before her husband was there, phone in hand. They started shouting at each other, and I started my car, tires spinning gravel as I turned around. I drove home, not really sure of what to think, what to do. I drove in silence. I couldn't get it out of my head. I pulled into my driveway, and the tears started to fall when the adrenaline wore off. I bawled at my steering wheel. It was wrong. Everything was wrong. My whole world came crashing down. No more blessings, no more cleanses. I took it all down. I'm done. The charade is over. I shut down the website, canceled all meet and greets and future appointments. I ghosted everyone like the fucking fraud I am. And now I'm done. I see their eyes when I sleep. In the back of my mind, I see the hanging pose, the geyser from the gaping wound, the clacking beaks. Days have passed now. The phone calls are getting less frequent, and the messages have died down. I made a post on social media announcing my resignation. My fans deserve better, but in the end, I'll only hurt them more. I'm moving soon, far enough away to escape the stain that is my own existence. I check in on the site from time to time, seeing the love from those I've helped in the past. I hope I really did help them somehow. Maybe it wasn't all a waste. I'm sorry, everyone. Really. Lacey sent me an email. It's 2 in the morning. I've read it 12 times, and I don't know what to do. Every time I read her name, I'm reminded of the clicking, the beaks echoing in my mind. Nothing makes it go away. I can only turn down the volume, but it never leaves. Why? Why won't it stop? "Father Kane, it took me a while to track you down. I'll understand if you don't respond, but I don't know who else to talk to. The door is open. My husband doesn't see it. It's always closed for him. But I can. It opens at night. It calls to me. I know you warned me, but I don't know how long I can resist. I just heard it open. I can hear it, the clicking. It's getting louder." That was My Last House Blessing by Jesse Pullins. Jesse Pullins is an American short fiction writer and Hawaiian shirt enthusiast from the Midwest. With a love for horror and suspense, he draws heavy inspiration from retro video games and classic creepypastas. And with that, dear listeners, we are done with tonight's episode. Switching from backcountry roads to the stylized desert landscape of the 80s and then back to quiet middle America, I've got a bit of whiplash. Time to settle down for the evening with a nice book, a glass of whiskey, and the soothing sounds of Slayer. But before I do so, I'd be remiss to not thank Jesse Pullins for his substantial contribution to tonight's episode. Also, my thanks go out to all of you for joining me. Next week, we'll bring a fresh episode of Horror Hill, and with it, some fresh chills. Until then, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. Note that any writing utilizing artificial intelligence is ineligible. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media, and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. That's ericpeabodyvoice. And we can talk details. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.